Thank you, Your Honor. Timothy Coates on behalf of Appellant Dr. Rivera. I would like to reserve five times for rebuttal. I will keep my eye on the clock as I start approaching that area. This case involves a confluence of two important policies under California law. And I think the importance is underscored by the nature and number of the amici in this case addressing both issues. One is the scope of the Medical Injury Compensation Reform Act, known informally as MICRA, and the other, the immunity provided to psychotherapists and psychiatrists under Civil Code Section 43.92 concerning the duty to warn a specified individual of a threat posed, a serious injury posed by a psychiatric or psychologist patient. I will turn first to the statute of limitations issue only because it also overlaps with the cross-field issue as to whether this is a professional negligence action within the meaning of MICRA. And I think that is settled, as the district court correctly recognized, by the California Supreme Court in Hedlund versus Superior Court, where the court, in the context of talking about a case based upon their failure to warn of an attack, that the diagnosis and appropriate steps necessary to protect the victim are not separate or severable, but together constitute the duty giving rise to the cause of action, which is to say, a physician doesn't make a decision whether to warn or not to warn unless they have made an assessment of the patient in the course of therapeutic treatment. And I think that brings it core within the terms of MICRA, certainly as interpreted by the California Supreme Court.
Can I ask a question about that? It's kind of been pitched as it's either a MICRA claim or it's, you know, it's not a MICRA claim. Couldn't it be both? Was there ever any other claim other than a MICRA claim at issue here? Could a plaintiff plead both a MICRA claim and a violation of the privacy separate from MICRA?
I don't think so, because so long as it arises out of the rendition of professional services, you still end up ultimately dealing with a claim covered by the act. Because again, the nature of the act is designed to cap damages, put other limitations for the benefit of protecting malpractice insurance rates from rising. That's the express purpose of it. It is a liability minimizing statute. There's just no question about it. And those purposes would be defeated if, in the course of providing medical treatment, you could get around it by saying, well, I'm just pleading something else, even though it directly arises out of the professional services you're rendering. A good example of this is the Barris versus County of Los Angeles case. It's a patient dumping case involving EMTALA, the federal statute. The federal statute liability standards are higher than mere negligence. They're not quite intentional tort, but they're pretty high, because you have to have kind of a, you're transferring a patient for an improper non-medical reason. And there, the plaintiff argued, you didn't transfer me because I was medically stable. You just wanted to dump me, typical EMTALA claim. And the Supreme Court said that claim is still governed by MICRA, because the determination of whether or not you're stable to transfer ultimately is a medical decision. And that goes back to the purposes of MICRA, to, you know, lower premiums. And I think that's exactly what we have here. It makes no sense to say that a physician's decision whether or not to warn is not tied to the diagnosis and treatment. And I'll get to it when we talk to the merits of the immunity, but I think that's shown here, because that's kind of what plaintiff's case eventually evolved into, was you negligently determined that I presented a risk that required a warning. So I think under the governing case law, this just isn't a circumstance where you are outside of MICRA. This is kind of the core medical judgment that these professionals exercise when they determine whether or not somebody presents a serious threat of injury to an identifiable party. The plaintiff cites his reply brief the Buchel case. I don't think that's any different. That is your standard informed consent case. The Supreme Court in California has recognized two types of informed consent cases. One is within MICRA. That's where you don't tell the plaintiff a potential complication. You have the operation, complication occurs, you then perform a surgery beyond what they expected. The other is where you've told them, they know, and then you go in and you do a completely different procedure. Another example, that's the Perry case, where a woman goes in for one type of surgery and comes out with an unwanted breast augmentation. Those are very extreme cases. there the conduct does not really arise out of the true exercise of medical judgment, but a conscious decision to do something that's not based on medical judgment. And I think here, again, you can see that plaintiff kind of edged into that because their whole case eventually, you know, evolved into this was a negligent diagnosis case. So I think under the governing case law, this squarely falls into Mike. The type of cases that don't are generally like the Bigler case where the person's selling a medical device or putting someone in a procedure that's not, that they have a financial interest in, but isn't really related to the actual medical care that's being provided. The So versus Shin case, good example. Intentional infliction claim. What was it based on? The doctor threw blood and tissue at the plaintiff. Not a difficult call, but that's not something doctors do. That's not really medical treatment. But those are the extreme kind of cases that get taken out of MICRA.
So what, I mean, what's interesting to me about your explanation is, it suggests that you could plead the two in the alternative, because there is some sort of a dividing line where it's a MICRA case if it's involved with their professional responsibilities.
Correct.
But if your allegation is, look, it, you know, it could be, I don't know whether it's going to be part of their professional responsibilities or an extreme example, they could plead both, couldn't they?
You can plead both, but if your facts ultimately go down into, was this medical judgment exercised properly, it's a MICRA case. And I think that's what we're getting down to.
Well, but I thought you were saying that in some of these other cases, like where the doctor threw the blood on the patient, that's not a MICRA case because that's not his professional duties. He was clearly acting outside of
that. Correct. That's not medical judgment or anything. That's getting angry at a
patient. Right, but that's my point, is that here, if I mean, isn't at some point, wouldn't that be a jury question? And maybe it's moot because that it doesn't appear that that was the question that was given to the jury in this case. It appears, at least, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that the jury was solely presented with a MICRA theory.
That's correct. But I will say that I think in this context where you're talking about a failure to warn based upon you've assessed a patient, you think he presents a threat to an identifiable individual, that's going to be inherently a medical determination, right? Because your decision to warn or not to warn is based upon your evaluation. And certainly that's what this case is based on. There's no allegation that this wasn't a product of Dr. Rivera's examination and exercise professional judgment. Basically, they said it was wrong or it didn't rise to a level sufficient under the statute, which I'll talk about on the merits of the immunity. But that's what their pitch was.
Can I just ask about the statute of limitations then?
Sure.
I mean, it seems to me it boils down to whether or not there's equitable tolling that applies to this statute. And we don't have a California case. Now, as I understand it, you are suggesting we should certify this question to the California Supreme Court. Is that right?
I think two answers to that. The one is, I think the Lancy case in dicta, and we acknowledge it is dicta, talks about 340.5 as not being tolled. Plaintiff cites the Belton case, which is statutory tolling, but I note that Lancy is after Belton, so I think the Supreme Court could well say, yes, you could have statutory tolling because you always assume the legislature knows what it's doing and you have to, you know, have statutes, interact in a rational manner. But that doesn't mean it's an open invitation on equitable tolling. I think Lancy is dictated that the court, under its case law, pretty much should follow, is required to follow. Second, we cite Gutierrez versus Mofeed, which is a one-year statute of limitations case, and the plaintiff argued, you know what, the statute should be told because I thought there was negligence. I went to an attorney, and he said there was no negligence. I didn't have a lawsuit. And the court used the term tolling when talking about that the one-year period is not tolled. That's the language Gutierrez uses. So I think the California Supreme Court has in Lancy kind of reaffirmed what it said in Gutierrez, because Gutierrez predates Lancy, I think, by at least 15 years or something about that.
So wait, are you suggesting it's clear enough we should decide this, or are you asking us to certify it to the California Supreme Court?
I'm saying if this court does not find Lancy or Gutierrez compelling, and it believes it's truly an open...
So, So your position is if we're not going to rule in your favor, then we should certify it.
Well, because I do think it would be a departure from California law, because if we have the California Supreme Court, even in dicta and Lancey, saying there's no tolling, and we have Gutierrez saying there's no tolling, if this court's going to find tolling, I think we should at least ask the California
Supreme Court. Does it matter whether it was at the motion to dismiss stage versus summary judgment? You didn't re-raise this question, this issue on summary judgment. But to me, it seems like it's a pure legal question. So I'm trying to figure out whether we should just, you know, defer to the district court because it was at the motion to dismiss stage. And, you know, it seemed plausible that there was a question about how much, you know, what Rivera knew at the time. Now there's not that question, but does it really change the answer to the statute of limitations?
I think it ultimately is just a pure question of law, because the district court said, denied the motion to dismiss because I find equitable tolling applies and there might be grounds for equitable tolling. If we were arguing that on the merits, there's no equitable tolling, no reasonable reliance, all those things, I think you'd be right, you know, because that is the kind of...
There's not really a dispute here on the facts. It's the dispute, to the extent that it, you know, is a real dispute, is a pure legal question.
Correct. I think that's correct, Your Honor. I will turn now to the merits of it, the 4392. And I think the Ewing 1 and Ewing 2 are the leading authorities on this. They're practically the only authorities. And I think it should be significant to the court, the absence of cases where there's an attempt to impose liability based upon an actual warning given. And I think it's because the statute is so protective. I mean, I think there's, you know, few instances, probably none, in which someone gives a warning in which the therapist doesn't at least have a subjective belief that the patient poses a dangerous, a serious threat of physical harm to an identifiable person. I think that's why you find more failure to warn type cases, because then something bad did happen. But Ewing 1 and Ewing 2 are critical, in which they point out that the inquiry about a serious injury threat, seriousness doesn't go to the likelihood that it's going to happen. The one thing that's abundantly clear from the legislative history, and it's made clear in Ewing 1 and Ewing 2, is it's not a battle of experts as to whether the therapist got it right as to the likelihood of attack. And that's because everybody recognized, the legislature in particular, the difficulty of predicting dangerousness. And that's why it only requires a serious threat. And in Ewing, the court notes, a threat of death is a serious threat as a matter of law. You don't need an expert to say death is serious.
Hold on a second, though, because I mean, if that were your interpretation, I mean, doesn't the statute say serious threat of grave bodily harm or death?
Yes.
So then why does it have serious? It could just say threat of grave bodily harm or death. The fact that it says serious suggests that serious does mean something different than referring just to the consequences of the threat, but it's how serious is the threat.
Well,
to me it would be the logical way to read that.
Two things. One, Ewing is very express in its interpretation of serious, right? It says serious goes to the nature of the threat. That's a holding of the California Court of Appeal, and I believe this court is bound by it unless it's clear the California Supreme Court would hold otherwise. That has been the law in the California for over 20 years. I think the court's probably not free to depart from that under its own case law. Second, the Ewing court talks about it being a threat. And I think if you get into that notion, how serious is it in order to warn? Does it have to be 50-50? Does it have to be 40%? You get right into the mischief that the legislature sought to avoid by not having...
There's got to be some limit, because under your theory, if there was a 1% chance of a death threat, then they'd be protected. And I don't know that I'm willing to go that far either.
Well, I mean, it may depend on whether you're the object of the death threat or not. I mean, I'm talking about an individual, if you get to 25 or 30%, here the doctor said it was low to moderate. If moderate's 40% and you're the potential target, that looks pretty significant to me if I'm the potential target. And I think what the legislature wanted to avoid getting into was precisely this sort of slicing and dicing down into increments.
Okay, counsel, I'm trying to figure out what the implication of your argument is. So I want to be very specific. What's the mistake that was made below?
The mistake made below was that there was undisputed evidence that Dr. Rivera believed this was an actual threat. She may have characterized it as low to moderate, but it was a threat of a serious injury within the meaning of the statute, which is death under the Ewing case, and that she actually believed, and then she did communicate it, which is what's required under the statute.
All right. So you still haven't told me what the mistake is. Now, you said there's undisputed evidence. Does that mean that the district judge should have taken this from the jury?
Yes, absolutely. The district court probably should have granted summary judgment when the case went to the jury, should not have gone to the jury. And
why is it wrong to go to the jury on whether the doctor thought there was an actual threat and whether the doctor actually believed? Why can't that be a jury question?
Because what would the evidence be that she didn't actually believe that? And in fact, plaintiff's case didn't focus on, again, whether or not Dr. Rivera actually believed it. It was she should not have opined that to begin with because she shouldn't have assessed him as a realistic threat, that this was a meaningful threat. That was 90% of the plaintiff's case. Plaintiff's counsel, even in argument, said, look, if you agree with me that this isn't serious, i.e. likely to occur, then you don't have to get to whether she believed it or not, because it's not a serious threat.
Okay. So counsel, at this point, to argue that the district court should have taken the issue from the jury is to tell us that the judge should have granted, that there's no way that the jury could have decided anything else.
Correct.
Okay, that's a very, very steep hill to climb.
You
had a battle of expert witnesses here, including Dr. V. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. I read her testimony on Friday, and I have to say I was very, very concerned about things that she was testifying to. I was very bothered by that. But then I went back to the district court's orders and discovered that you insisted that the plaintiffs had to show that there was a violation of her professional duty here, and that you proposed your own witness, and that you had, so we had a battle of expert witnesses as to whether the duty of care had been violated. And if so, it looks to me like you've left the door wide open for this.
No, for two reasons. One, in the motion for summary judgment, we argued the immunity. In response, plaintiff submitted Vieten's testimony, by the way, again, under this misnomer that you can erode the immunity by arguing it was a misdiagnosis. Judge, district court denies.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question. At least for me, looking at the record, it looks like that your motion for judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, was late, and the motion was converted to Rule 60. So it really seems like you haven't preserved the sufficiency of the evidence based upon filing a late motion.
I will note, Your Honor, that the judge treated it as a Rule 60 motion and went to the merits of it as to whether it had to be vacated and a new judgment entered. And so he did treat it as and rule on the merits. You're right, the Rule 50 motion was late, but the district court did exercise its discretion and reached the merits on this issue. On Judge Bybee's question, again, you try the case as it ends up being presented. We do not think this should have gone to the jury at all. Under California law, if you're going to have a medical malpractice professional negligence action, you have to have testimony on the standard of care. Now here, the standard of care probably is, do you know what 4392 provides? Physicians need to know that. But the other aspect, which was, were you negligent in diagnosing, is not part of the case. Ewing makes that clear. The legislative history makes that clear. We move to exclude Vieten's testimony on the grounds that you're just going to testify about negligence. That's not what the standard is. So yes, you can have an expert come in and say, you need to understand what 4392 provides, but at the same time, you don't get to say, oh, and by the way, you breached the standard of care because you didn't accurately diagnose. That clearly is something that the legislature did not want to have happen at trial. Very clear from the case law. It's not a battle of experts on whether you got it right.
Counsel, did you ask the district court to give the jury a specific verdict? That is, to ask them to answer specific questions and then put the Ewing test in there?
Not on that.
Did they ask for that?
No. The court has anything else?
Okay, thank you. We'll give you some extra time on rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you.
Mr. Norton.
Good morning. Fred Norton on behalf of Ronald Turner. May it please the court. I think part of the problem that we have here on this appeal is that the arguments that Dr. Rivera wants to make now, are at war with the arguments that she made in the trial court. And I'm going to get to that within some specific points. But I think there are five points that I need to address to some extent between the appeal and the cross appeal. And the first is whether this is a micro case. It's not. The second is whether the statute of limitations barred his claims. It does not. And then I can get to the substantial evidence issue, which I do think is forfeited, and the instructional questions. Now, is this a micro case? It is not. My friend was asked, can you have both a claim that is microclaim and a claim that is not? And absolutely you can. We cited that case. It's at page 31 of our brief. It's Waters versus Borges. And the California Supreme Court said, of course you can have both. And in fact, each of these cases that we're talking about, the Perry case, the So case, the Unruh case, in each of those, there is a claim for medical malpractice. And there is an additional claim for an intentional tort. And the plaintiffs in those cases prevailed on their medical malpractice claims.
Well, so is your position you pled an invasion of privacy claim separate and apart from medical malpractice?
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, okay, so you say absolutely, but yet when there's a pro se complaint here, so I understand we got to read it in light of the rules for reading a pro se complaint, but then when counsel, and I don't recall whether you were the counsel or not, but they came in and tried to amend the complaint and add privacy claims, and the district court said no, we're not going to do that at this late date. Doesn't that sort of undermine the position that there were privacy claims already existing if they tried to amend to add them?
It did not happen quite that way, so let me address that. So I did come in shortly before trial. The complaint, the second amended complaint filed pro se, alleged a claim for medical malpractice and alleged a claim under California Civil Code Section 1714, which is California's general tort statute. And what we asked was that the jury be instructed on each of the theories that were consistent with the general tort claim. And so that was an invasion of privacy claim. That was a violation of the private right of action for invasion of privacy under the California Constitution, and a violation of California statute, which protects confidential medical information, the CMIA. All of those were subsumed within the claim. And what we pointed to when we made that argument to the court was, this is already in the case. It's already in the complaint. Everybody's always understood it was in the complaint. If you look at the supplemental excerpts of record at page 33, which was the brief that we filed, pretrial brief, we cited the case management statements, the complaint, the court's own characterization. Over and over again, this was described throughout the case as a privacy case. It was a privacy case, and absolutely, there was a medical malpractice claim in there as well, but it was a privacy case. Dr. Rivera, in her case management statements, the joint statements, characterized it as a privacy claim. So everybody knew that's what the case was about.
So you're saying, your position is, from the get-go, this was always a dual case, medical malpractice, a micro case, and a privacy court case.
He pled two causes, even in his pro se complaint.
Is that how it was pitched to the jury? Because I had the impression that what ultimately went to the jury was just the micro portion of this.
Well, to be clear, there's no such thing as a micro portion. There's a claim. And what went to the court, went to the jury rather, was only a medical malpractice claim. And that's the error that we assigned to the trial court, is we asked the court to instruct on all the theories in the complaint. And the district court agreed with us that those theories were in the complaint.
But they did not instruct on them.
Did not instruct on them. That's
okay, this is the problem, because at this point, what was sent to the jury was a micro case. I mean, a micro claim. That's it. So if you're correct, don't we have to send it back for a new trial so that the jury could also consider negligence? And is that really in your client's best interest?
Well, if you're inclined to send it back, I would rather you send it back for a new trial. But I don't think you send it back. Let me explain why. The error that we assigned to the trial court, the only error we assigned to the trial court, was the failure to instruct on these claims. had the court instructed on these claims, there's no dispute as to what the elements are. The elements are that there was a disclosure of confidential information without consent. And there's no dispute that that happened. There's no dispute that we proved that because we were required to prove it in the malpractice claim that we actually prevailed upon at trial. So on this record, you can conclude that had the court instructed on the theories that were in the complaint, we would have prevailed. And we make this argument in our appeal brief. So for that reason, I think that we don't need that.
So you just want us... You just want us to take it outside of MICRA because there were claims that were not presented to the jury, but had they been, they would have also resulted in a verdict for your client.
Yes, but I want to address your other point.
Is there any precedent for that, though?
I cannot point you to any precedent for that particular proposition, that a theory that was pled but not presented to the jury. Here's what I think would happen, is that we would go back and we would make a motion that... based on the findings the jury made at the original trial, that there is that Dr. Rivera is stopped or precluded from contesting those findings because they weren't necessarily found by the jury in the first trial. But I don't think we need to do that, and I'd like to explain why. You characterize the claim that went to the jury as a microclaim. Now, there's no such thing as a microclaim in that sense. There are claims for professional negligence.
Right.
And my argument here is that even the claim that we tried is not properly understood as a claim for professional negligence. And when we do this microanalysis in the California state courts, we don't get hung up on labels. We have to focus on what is the nature of the claim, right? And the nature of the claim here, as the district court said on the eve of trial, is this case has always been about Dr. Rivera's disclosure of Mr. Turner's confidential information. So then we go to, well, what are the cases say about what the standard is for what's a micro case and what's not? Because as we all know, there are all these cases that involve doctors treating patients and in the course of the treatment doing something that does not qualify for micro protection, right? In Perry, that's the case in which the doctor obtained consent while the patient was under medication and gave her a breast enlargement that she never wanted. She claimed that she had been given insufficient anesthesia, woke up during the middle of the procedure, and then when the anesthesiologist realized that it happened, he threw tissue and blood at her and said, don't report this. She won on her medical malpractice claim, but she also won on her intentional tort claim. So these are all wrapped up in the treatment of the patient. Nonetheless, they're not microclaims ultimately. So in our
case... No, but that's not true. One claim, if, for example, the intentional tort in the blood example, if the intentional tort claim had not been presented to the jury, it would have been a microclaim because it would have only been a professional malpractice claim, right?
Well, you would still have to look past the label. And so the question would be, is the thing that you are complaining about the diagnosis? And Mr. Coates wants to say that the complaint was about a diagnosis, and that's not true. The complaint was not about a diagnosis. The complaint was that Dr. Rivera called the police and told them something that was not true based on information that Mr. Turner had provided in confidence. That was our claim. And we never had to prove that she got the diagnosis wrong in order to prevail on that claim. That was our claim. And so if you look at what we claim the standard of care was, is it on cross-examination?
But you would agree that the way you're characterizing it right now would require us to reverse the district court because I don't think the district court had the same understanding of the case that you do right now. Now, the district court might have been wrong, but what you're telling us right now would require us to reverse the district court, right?
Well, I would ask that you reverse the district court on its determination that our claim was a microclaim, in which case you would reinstate the jury verdict for the full amount without the micro damages cap. But the reason why I'm so focused on this issue is that when we look at what the MICRA cases say, they say that in order for the case to be subject to MICRA, right, the claim has to be based on the defendant's failure to adhere to a standard of care, right? That's in the Bigler case, right? So is that our claim? Now, our claim was that this is not a professional standard of care. This is the duty that everybody has to maintain confidences. The second critical proposition.
Well, but you still, you did present, and I understand there were some dynamics around why you did this, but at the end of the day, you presented an expert witness that, you know, purported to testify as to what the standard of care was, right?
We did, because Dr. Rivera forced us to, absolutely. And I don't want to lose sight of this fact, because it is very important to the sequence of events here, and my concern that the arguments that are being made on appeal now are contradictory to what Dr. Rivera argued before. When she moved for summary judgment, she moved, and she moved with an expert declaration. And she moved because she said her client complied with the standard of care, which she said came from Section 4392. Now, that doesn't make any sense, because Section 4392 is an affirmative defense, and she pled it as an affirmative defense. So it was a bit incoherent, I think, but the argument that she made was that the standard of care would be established by experts. And that was her argument from the moment she filed for summary judgment on. But I want to come back.
Counsel, I had a question. For the purposes of looking at the verdict that we have, if we assume what went to the jury was a microclaim, is the significance of that, separate from your cross appeal about what was not allowed, whether or not a 1 or 3 year statute of limitations applies, and whether there's equitable tolling? So is that where this goes?
It's important to both. So one, of course, is it would, if I'm correct on MICRA, the verdict is reinstated. If I'm correct on MICRA, we don't talk about Section 340.5. That's the wrong statute of limitations. And we're under a different statute where everybody agrees we get equitable tolling. So let me turn in just one moment to the statute of limitations, just finish on the MICRA issue. The only other point I want to make clear on the MICRA issue is that the question, that the second issue, second rule that we see in all these MICRA cases is, was the doctor providing the patient with health care? The thing that is being complained about is that the providing with health care is throwing blood on the patient providing health care? Of course not. Is lying to the patient about what you're doing with their genetic material in UNRU? Is that medical care? It's not. So what did Dr. Rivera do? What did she do? She called the police. That's not medical care. It's not medical care.
Well, hold on a second. I mean, but it's clearly connected to her medical duties. That seems to be different here, because I mean, you would agree that if a client came in to a counselor, had a weapon in hand and said, I'm leaving here and I'm going to go shoot up the local school, wouldn't you agree at that point that that the counselor has an affirmative duty based on her professional responsibility to call the police immediately?
No. And the reason why the answer is no is that duty is not a medical duty. It is a duty created by a statute. And that statute is Section 4392. But it's not based on any diagnosis. And this is the other point that Mr. Coates gets wrong, because he wants to cite to Headland. And as the district court correctly found, relying on Ewing, Headland is a dead letter. So the issue in Headland, MICRA did apply. And the reason why it applied was that at that time, under Tarasoff and Headland, the California Supreme Court had said that psychotherapists have an obligation to diagnose dangerousness. You have to apply the professional standards to determine whether a person is dangerous. And an example you gave under Headland, yes, it would be the law was, you as a professional, you must predict. But Ewing tells us, and we agree on this. In fact, their third brief is replete with this argument. Ewing makes quite clear that under Section 4392, this duty is not a medical duty. It's based on objective facts. Was a threat actually made? Did the doctor sincerely believe that a threat had been made? And did the doctor take reasonable steps to communicate
it? So I'm looking at 4392. So if I understood you correctly, you just told us that under Judge Nelson's hypothetical, that the treating therapist or psychiatrist does not have a duty to call the police. Not based in common life. It's a duty based on the statute?
There is no duty that arises from the fact that they are a professional, because you don't look to the standards for psychotherapists to make that decision.
That comes out of that's my reading of Tarasoff.
Your reading of Tarasoff is 100% correct, but Ewing tells us that 4392 amends the Tarasoff rule and amends it to take into consideration Justice Mosk's concerns in dissent. And Justice Mosk's concerns in dissent, as Ewing tells us, was that it was not correct, not appropriate, to impose a standard of care on psychotherapists that made them predict dangerousness. So the court said, the legislature said, we won't do that.
Right, the 4392 doesn't, I can't read any provision in there as creating a duty. I see it only as creating an immunity if you exercise the duty that's created under Tarasoff.
4392A is the duty, 4392B is the duty.
That is the strangest language creating a duty. There shall be no monetary liability on the part of, and no cause of action shall arise against. That doesn't sound like anything that creates a duty in any reasonable construction of the English language.
So the obligation to the duty to protect comes from 4392A, not B. But I do want to make sure I address the statute of limitations argument, because it's a distinct argument and it's important that we get there. So even if I'm wrong on MICRA, we would still have to look at section 340.5. And section 340.5 has an outer bound and a lower bound of, you know, the two prongs, right? And so—
1 year versus the 3 year.
Exactly. And so what we know from Belton is that, and we know from 340.5, is that—
It can be equitably told by statute.
It can be equitably told, full stop. So what Belton says is you got these two portions of the statute, and there's a clause in the statute which says for the 3 year outer bound, there will be tolling only for these specified reasons. And Belton tells us now that prohibition on tolling beyond the 3 years applies only to the 3 years. And we agree on that. Mr. Coates and I agree on that. So Belton tells us that language that says there shall be no tolling beyond the 3 years except for these reasons tells you nothing about the 1 year discovery rule. So what do we know about the 1 year discovery rule? It's just like every other tolling statute in California. And under Addison, which we cite, equitable tolling is generally available. That's the law in California. That's the settled law in California. Now, to get around that, and by the way, that's the way four federal judges have interpreted that. They've allowed for equitable tolling in these cases. They've all recognized it.
You mean specifically using 340.5?
Absolutely. Those cases are Warney, Gray, Rigetti, and Thomas, all cited by us and by the district court. So what's on the other side of the ledger here? All right, so there's Gutierrez, and Gutierrez does not say that we don't get equitable tolling. What Gutierrez says is that if your complaint is that your lawyer told you you had no claim, you don't get equitable tolling. That's all we know from Gutierrez, right? Which is not surprising. You might have a claim against your lawyer, but we don't give people equitable tolling for that. So then they go to Lancey. Now, Lancey doesn't help them either. It's not a 340.5 case at all. It's a different statute, but it has the same structure, outer bound, lower bound. And in that case, the court says, when the legislature, and it has exactly the same problem, is the outer bound told, equitably told? And the court says it's not equitably told. But again, we're talking about the outer bound. And the court is completely clear that what we're talking about here is when can you get equitable tolling of the outer bound when the statute says you only get tolling for specific reasons? Right? But the court is very specific in Lancey, that you do not get, that they're not talking about the discovery rule. They're only talking about that outer bound for which the legislature said you don't get tolling beyond the outer bound. Right? So Lansky doesn't change anything about Benton. Moreover, Lansky says, and this is important for the procedural posture of the case, you can still get equitable estoppel. You can still get equitable estoppel of the statute of limitations. So, and found it was appropriate in that case to do so. So the reason why that's important here is that the pro se complaint had other bases that would make it timely. One was statutory tolling, that Dr. Rivera was outside the state. That's, you can see that from the face of the complaint. We don't have a record on that because Dr. Rivera never came back to the issue. But there's also equitable estoppel, because what happened here was Mr. Turner went to see, a Marine veteran went to the Veterans Administration, had his competences violated, filed a timely claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act.
Well, counsel, I think just for myself, if equitable tolling applies, I don't think there's a dispute as a legal matter. I don't think there's a dispute that the facts here would support it. I think the real question is that threshold legal.
All right, but my, and I appreciate that, but even if I lost on that point, you couldn't enter judgment for Dr. Rivera, because on the face of the complaint, we have to go back to what was, this is the question, what was the district court's error? And the error would be that it should have dismissed the complaint, but it would have to be with leave to amend. And here we would have grounds to amend for equitable estoppel, because Dr. Rivera never told Mr. Turner that she was a staffing psychiatrist who had no employment relationship with the Veterans Administration. So he had no way to know that until Dr. Rivera said, you're too late. I am past my time. I did want to spend a moment, if I may, to address the substantive argument.
We'll give you another minute and we'll add it on.
Go ahead. Thank you. On the question of 4392, there were jury instructions, and to Judge Bybee's question, what was the error below? Dr. Rivera doesn't actually identify an error. She just wants to argue that she was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. There were jury instructions. They're not challenged here on appeal. The jury instructions track the elements of Section 4392, and they had three parts. Is there an actual threat? And that's California law. It has to be an actual threat. We get that from Ewing. We get it from Calderon. There must be a threat. From Ewing and other cases, there's this additional gloss, which is that the therapist must actually believe there is a credible threat. And there was substantial evidence that she did not believe it. Now, Mr. Coates said we didn't argue that. Not only did we argue it, if you look at my closing argument, I spent 10 pages of the closing argument walking through the specific evidence which showed there never was a threat. Objectively, he did not make a serious threat. A serious, credible threat, which is how the instruction defining serious threat was given to the jury. Of course we argued that. Then there's 5 pages of me walking through all the evidence which says that Dr. Rivera did not believe there was a threat, because she didn't say there was a serious threat. She didn't act like there was a serious threat. And not a single person she spoke to told her there was a serious threat. They said the opposite. She did not believe that. And we absolutely argued that. So the jury had ample evidence on which to conclude that Dr. Rivera, who had the burden of proof on this issue, did not meet it. And so for that reason as well, the jury verdict, they don't argue substantial evidence. They don't say they're even subject to substantial evidence. So our argument would be MICRA does not apply, should not have applied. On the theories pled in the complaint, he should have been allowed to recover the full amount the jury gave him. It's clear that equitable tolling applies under 340.5, as federal courts have held. And under the substantial evidence standard, which is what applies here, the jury verdict on the affirmative defense must stand.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And Mr. Coates, I'm not sure how much time. Let's add at least 2 minutes. Let's give them 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Much appreciated. You know, turning to the merits argument on 4392, our position is we were right on summary judgment, that if you look at the standards of 4392, they're met in terms of what the evidence as to what Dr. Rivera subjectively believed. A lot of their, she didn't believe it, turns on that low to moderate language, which, as we know, we think under the statute, you don't go into those kind of qualitative determinations. Our expert said that the issue is, did she comply with 4292, so she's outside the Tarasoff standard? That's the only professional thing at issue here. Is this the standard, and is this met? Their expert, Dr. Veaton, testifies in opposition to summary judgment, then repeats it at trial. No, it wasn't a serious threat because she was wrong in determining that it was likely to occur. And again, I know it sounds like a broken record. If you look at Ewing, if you look at the legislative history, the one thing that is absolutely clear is the legislature did not want there to be a battle of the experts as to whether or not there was a correct diagnosis. And that goes whether there's a likelihood or how great the likelihood, because you're going to put that camel's head into the tent and you're going to have the exact same problem if you start slicing and dicing how much is enough to trigger the duty to warn. 40%, 30%, 25%. that's something that I think in drafting 4392, the legislature did not want to get into, and they didn't want that to come in the back door, as it did here through a medical negligence case, by having a doctor come in and say that wasn't enough to be a serious.
Counsel, the concern I have about your argument as you're presenting it now is you're basically giving a free pass in these circumstances that, of course a doctor is going to warn, and you're incentivizing them to warn under any circumstance. They hear any threat of death, whether it's imagined, a dream, anything, they're incentivized to go report that because they have a professional duty, perhaps to report it. But your position is they can't be held liable under the law because it's a threat of death.
Well, the case law is, do they sincerely believe? Not if it's a joke. Ewing makes that point. Not if they make statements like, oh, this is incredible, I really don't believe this, but I'm erring on the side of caution. That's not what the evidence is. But you are absolutely right. This is an extremely protective standard. It is designed to be an extremely protective standard. It is designed to err on the side of caution if there's an actual belief that a threat is presented. It is a policy decision the legislature made to encourage the duty to warn, because the backlash against Tarasov, which they thought was going to give rise to, absolutely this kind of, you're going to warn all the time or you're going to be afraid of being sued. So the legislature drew this balance. And I again think it's telling, you look at California case law, you will not find a case out there based upon giving an improper warning. And I think it's because the statute is drafted the way it is. This is plainly MICRA. It is based upon her exercise of professional judgment, because she only makes the report because of her diagnosis. Headland remains good law on that point. A case they cite, Unruh Haxton, even cites it for that point. And I note, if the court again is debating whether this is a MICRA claim, that's a sea change under Headland. I would certify that to the California Supreme Court, because that's a nuclear bomb in psychiatric practice.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both counsel for a real job well done on helping us to clarify a very complicated case. So the case is now submitted, and we will turn to our third and final case set for argument today, State of Washington versus United States Department of State, case number 20-35391. And Mr. Aguilar, are you prepared?